from Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse Bureau, and I'm joined by a panel of guests today to talk about the important issue of suicide awareness and prevention. We're going to be talking to Judge Todd Bierke, who's a local judge here, but he's also the president of the board for the National Alliance on Mental Illness in La Crosse and Vernon Counties. Judge Bierke, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ezra.
We're joined also by Aaron Swigum, who's a family nurse practitioner who specializes in urgent care at Vernon Memorial. Aaron, thank you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Ezra.
We're talking to Dr. Neil Bramett of the Gunderson Health System, who works in psychiatry and behavioral health. Thank you for joining us today.
For having me, Ezra.
Certainly. So the issue of suicide awareness, suicide prevention, most of us are at least familiar with people in our lives who have dealt with this issue in one way or another, have been affected by it, lives touched by it, lives taken by it. It's such an important thing. Let me start with you, Neil. Who is it who's most at risk for suicide?
Yeah, Ezra, thanks again for having us. And that's a good question. And I think that one of the biggest risk factors for suicide is having either a previous history of a suicide attempt or suicidal thoughts, and also if you have a identified mental illness like depression, but even absent a mental illness, if the circumstances and life situations are such. Things can culminate. Even someone who doesn't have a history of thoughts or an attempt could be at risk. So, but when we think about highest risk groups, teenagers and young adults, as well as older adults, folks who are don't have a partner, who are single, that loneliness. As well, and also individuals who are struggling with a substance use disorder. Alcohol tends to be one of the key cofactors found in completed suicide attempts, and that's a significant risk factor as well.
The substance abuse piece is a big one. Like you said, it plays a role in this problem in particular. But so many people who are dealing with issues, like depression or like other kinds of mental health issues that might result in someone attempting to take their own life, often they start to self-medicate by doing something like turning to drink or drugs or something like that. How can people learn other coping mechanisms besides, turning to drugs and alcohol when life gets too much for them to bear?
Well, I work with the treatment courts here in La Crosse County, and the one I preside over is the Veterans Court. So I deal a lot with veterans. If you're not aware of it, there's about 22 veterans each day that take their lives by suicide because of the things that Dr. Brombutt has just referenced. Many of them have PTSD, which has a very heavy depression component to it. PTSD is not something you can fix per se, but, through behavioral modification and perhaps the right drugs to address the depression or grief or other co-issues, they can get on track to have a good life. But many of the veterans I see have resorted, like you said, to using alcohol or drugs, and a lot of them end up getting into trouble. So I see them in the criminal system. That is a very large facet of the public that has tendency, I guess, to go toward suicide when they are at their low. And it's not just the veterans, but that's just a class of people that I do see.
That's Judge Todd Bierke, who's the board president as well for NAMI and La Crosse and Vernon County. Judge Bierke, you talked about seeing these things in your court. I don't know how you could keep, you know, specific statistics on all these things, but anecdotally, how often do things find their way into the legal system that originate as mental health issues?
I would say that the vast majority of the cases we see have some sort of substance abuse issue connected to the individual, you know, whether they're using methamphetamine or a drunk driver, what have you. And underlying that generally will be some component of a mental health issue that they're probably self-medicating with. Just about anyone that gets in legal trouble may fall into that category. They can't make good decisions on paying rent, so they may be evicted. So those people could be in that category. Small claims for not paying on their debt, to get into disputes, domestics or otherwise, fights at the bars. The police contact them, they become resistive. And, you know, La Crosse County, the police have a lot of training on crisis intervention and de-escalation. And other communities, they don't necessarily train the police exactly like that, like they do here. And there's, you know, plenty of communities where people are even gravely injured as a result of the police contact because of that mental health component. In La Crosse, they do a very good job of trying to de-escalate and try to find out what the person really needs. A lot of times it does result in criminal arrest, but a lot of times they do try to refer them on a chapter or to some other place where they can get some help for mental issues.
Aaron Swigum is with Vernon Memorial. Aaron, you work in urgent care there, and you see people who are really coming in when they're not feeling their best, and when they are often in crisis. How many of the cases that you see at work are experiencing either suicidal thoughts or have even tried to take their own lives?
Well, I would say that a lot of the people that I see, I can't really connect them so much with the suicidality in the urgent care setting as much as I can connect them with trauma and personal trauma, PTSD. A lot of the people seeking emergency treatment are coming in often repetitively. You know, they may be with addictions, they may be with depression, anxiety, PTSD. You'll see the list, ADHD. It just kind of goes on and on. But my own personal experience is more with my husband, who took his life 15 months ago. So that's kind of where my connection comes more in than in my practice. I've had some intimate connections with a couple patients, but more so it's personal. And he had a history of our time together was very brief, had a history of addiction, history of probably PTSD. In the end, I realized he had a history of bipolar as I watched him cycle. And so I think the addiction and mental health and suicide all go very closely together. So I can't really answer that question perfectly, as my patient population comes in with sprained ankles a lot and
sure,
ear infections and such.
Well, thank you for sharing the personal side of your story as well. I know it must be difficult to talk about, and yet it's I know that there are people in our audience who will definitely benefit from it and appreciate that. If I may turn to that side of our discussion for just a moment, what were the warning signs that you might have seen, or what did you later after your husband's death, what did you recognize about his experiences that might have been a signpost that things might turn out the way that they did?
Our last, I would say, 3 months were pretty difficult with he was manic and becoming more and more manic. And again, we were together for 2 years, so I think I only really saw one complete cycle for him. So in his mania, it was a lot of grand ideas that became somewhat delusional. They were beautiful. I mean, he could have all sorts of ideas and beautiful plans, but they were very grand, and we had a hard time staying focused. And then it would cycle with rage. So it was a lot of grandeur and then rage. And then the cycles just were getting shorter and shorter. So I did recognize that he was delusional. And I would say that one of the most difficult things is we did seek help, and being connected to the medical community is a beautiful thing. But knowing what I knew and watching it happen and unable to really stop it was really difficult.
What was your husband's name, Aaron?
His name was Christopher Hendrickson.
When you were there with Christopher while he was in trouble, you talked about the connection to the medical community. Were you able to rely on that expertise in how to handle the difficult things that he was going through, or did you always, I mean, you talked about part of the time you kind of felt like an observer who, you know, in spite of your education and experience, couldn't do as much.
You know, it was difficult in that when he did get help, I wasn't present, which was appropriate. But he was able to just paint such a beautiful picture. I mean, we were doing so much good work on ourselves, and he was doing a lot of good work on himself with mindfulness. When you talked about tools, I do think that mindfulness and behavioral therapies are very useful. But we were doing a lot of good work. So I think that he was able to present a picture that seemed like we were doing okay and getting better. But this was also at the time of the pandemic. This was right after the lockdown, and our lives just flipped right upside down. My role here at Vernon Memorial was changing very quickly and evolving. And I was putting a lot of hours in here. He had to leave his job. So there were just a lot of things that happened in a real brief period of time. So it's hard to gauge. The whole thing is just kind of surreal in many ways.
That's Aaron Swigum, who's a family nurse practitioner at Vernon Memorial. And as she shared, she lost her husband, Christopher, who took his own life. We're also visiting with Judge Todd Bierke, who's the president of the board for the National Alliance on Mental Illness in La Crosse and Vernon County, and Dr. Neil Brombat, a psychiatry and behavioral health provider at Gunderson Health Systems. Dr. Brombat, I want to ask you about warning signs. We heard Aaron's very personal experience. If other people have loved ones that they're worried about, what are some of these warning signs that we should be on the lookout for?
Question, and Aaron, thank you for sharing that personal story, and sorry for your loss and your family's loss. You know, some of the warning signs I think, you know, that stand out to me are kind of a change from someone's baseline, whether it's a close family or a friend or a coworker or a colleague. If you notice kind of a change in behavior, isolation, maybe not responding to reaching out as much, activities of daily living. And what I mean by that is just like caring for oneself. If someone's starting to let themselves go. Another red flag in terms of at times, if it's not an impulsive act and it's planned, individuals may start to give away objects and personal belongings of significant value and planning of that sort. and access to firearms and new acquisition of firearms in that case as well. I think that's an important a piece, and those are some of the things that stand out in my mind for that question.
You're listening to Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have interest in hearing part of this segment again, or maybe a previous episode that you might have missed, you can find all of them at our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. If you'd like to submit a topic for our future discussions, or if you have a question about this show that we can follow up on at a later date, you can send us those comments to newsmakers@wpr.org. Our conversation will continue in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall, joined today by Judge Todd Bierke, by Aaron Swigum, and by Dr. Neil Brombett, and we are talking about the important issue of suicide awareness and suicide prevention. I'm very interested to get to some tools that people can use, as Aaron called them, tools, some resources that might be available. We've been talking about things off the air like different numbers to call and different resources that might be available for people, and we'll get to all the different categories of those things. Let's just talk about the first things first. Judge Bierke, maybe you can start with just if somebody's in crisis and they know they need to talk to somebody, not quite sure where to turn, what's a good place for them to reach out?
Well, at least in the La Crosse area, we have some good resources. We have an agency called 211. You could call them for just about anything, how to get to a restaurant if you wanted that. But also, if you are in crisis, they can do referrals to different providers, depending on what your need is. They have someone that will talk to you, and they have a very exhaustive database to try to help connect you. Part of the problem with mental health, though, is when people are in crisis, they need to get somewhere right away. And one of the big obstacles is a lot of times there's nothing for them, perhaps short of an emergency room or other drastic measures. And when people need to get to see, say, someone like Dr. Brombott in his office, you know, that may be a couple of weeks before they can make that appointment. So people need to be able to access the proper resource at the proper time. 211 is a big resource. People, if they want just information about mental health, can go to the NAMI.org website. They could call 911 if it's truly an emergency, and perhaps the police will come out. But too often we have people that are subject to the stigma of mental illness, and they hide everything about what they are feeling. And it's not like physical ailments where you can see a broken leg or a black eye or what have you. When they hide their mental issues, it's so hard to work with them. And even when you know they have mental illness that's been diagnosed, they still are an individual that have rights. And no matter how much you want to help them, they can push you away.
And Dr. Brombott, maybe for someone who knows that they've had difficult thoughts that they don't quite know what to do with, thoughts about ending their own life, or maybe thoughts about their life coming to an end. If they're not in crisis, maybe they don't need 911, maybe they don't need 211. But how does somebody begin that conversation that might lead to the kind of help that they need? Is that something that they can just bring up in their doctor's office, or who do they talk to about that?
And just kind of going back to the acute or immediate resources, there is the suicide prevention lifeline.org, the phone number being 1-800-273-8255. That's a resource that could be tapped into at any time if, individual, yourself or a family member or anyone out there is feeling a sense of hopelessness and thoughts about death, dying, or ending their life. And Ezra, you asked, can you walk into your primary care doctor's office and talk about this? Surely. And I think that kind of goes back to what Todd was talking about, just Virki, about a stigma. And, you know, I think it's important to help increase awareness of mental illness and reduce stigma such that it makes it easier for folks to ask for help. And the sense of hopelessness that can come along with thoughts about death, dying, or ending your life, or depression, or any other mental illness, are, at the time, one may not know this, but it's transient, and that there is help. And you can even reach out to a friend, a neighbor, a colleague, anyone you even trust that can get you to that the door of help. So, you know, whether it's the emergency room, your primary care doctor, a neighbor, a friend, knowing that it's okay to reach out for help, and that's actually a strength and not a weakness.
You talked about the lifeline, 800-273-8255. Judge Bierke mentioned 211 earlier, of course, 911. If you're in the middle of any kind of emergency, that's a good and appropriate place to start. What about, like, are there support groups for this kind of thing, or are there tools that people can use of a more behavioral nature? People who know that they might struggle with these issues, but who might be looking for kind of a way to get through it? Or I know the PTSD discussion. I mean, there are ways that people can get help for that and support for those kinds of things. Do you need to have a specific diagnosis like that to qualify to participate in some kind of support group? Or is there one related to things that might lead someone to try to take their life?
Well, Ezra, this is Erin. I just wanted to mention a couple other things that speak to that. I think we talked about addiction and mental health and suicide connections, and the recovery community is a huge resource for people. AA, NA, I think another wonderful resource that La Crosse has is the Franciscan Spirituality Center. I've found a lot of hope there, and there's a survivors of suicide group there that I've yet to join, but I know it's there. So I think the recovery community is one of the biggest resources where you're going to find community of like-minded people.
Erin, you talked about resources for people who have personally experienced suicide, be it somebody close to them in their family or other kinds of loved ones, friends, people in their life. What are the resources that you turned to with your experience in this being so recent?
Mm-hmm. I mean, my first resource was friends and family. You know, they just kind of swept me up and took care of me and took me in for as long as it took. My workplace was a resource. They just showered me with so much love and compassion. And then as I was able to read a little more and get a little more into it, David Kessler was a huge resource for me. And he writes about the five stages of grief. And then he also puts a sixth stage in, which is finding purpose, which I'm mostly grateful for. And then over the last few months, I've started counseling at the Spirituality Center with Sister Sarah, and she was just in La Crosse Tribune. So as being one of the mental health advocates in La Crosse County. So those were the biggest resources for me, I would say.
I'm curious about some of the things that people say that concern us. You hear somebody who is in the throes of depression or bad circumstances or something talk about how I wish my life was just over. I wish it could all just go away. Versus somebody who might say, like, I am going to take my life or something like that. Dr. Bomba, is Is that just semantics, or should we be equally concerned about those, both of those kinds of statements?
I would be equally concerned about both of those kind of statements. I think that what that statement means to a particular individual at any given time is hard to ascertain without really getting a sense and peeling the layers of the onion. And, you know, for instance, sometimes people will make a suicide attempt and maybe they took, you know, just several pills of something that like multivitamins, let's just say, for instance, but the significance that it holds to them and if they felt that this could potentially end their life is really the message that you want to try to decode. So I would take any signs and symptoms seriously, and especially the absence of them. I would say if, you know, a loved one or a friend is noticing that an individual is going through significant changes, whether it's, you know, significant financial loss, a divorce, legal issues, whether they be civil or criminal, these are significant risk factors. And if they're all coalescing at one time and a person is not showing any emotion or seeming to be affected, I'd also look into that as well.
Judge Bierke, when people start talking to each other about important issues like this, how do we know how to bring up something? I don't feel equipped to give somebody life-saving advice or anything. I mean, I'm certainly willing to listen to any of my loved ones who has a concern they need to talk about. But if somebody's going through something like that, I don't know what to say. How do people bring that up in conversation?
Well, the biggest thing is being a good listener and making sure you stay with them. Like Dr. Brombitt said, you need to dig a little deeper to find out how serious it is at the moment. And if it's serious enough, you call 911 or someone else to help intercede. So a professional can take over for you and you stay with the person. But otherwise, if you talk with them and you find out they're just really struggling at the moment and are fretting and they have no plan and you feel that they will still be safe, you try to help them get an appointment. Maybe you take them to the appointment, walk them down to the emergency room so someone can assess them if you feel it's necessary. So again, you need information, but you don't get that unless you listen and you look and try to discover where it needs to go. And you don't need to have any special expertise to do that other than compassion and understanding and want to support that person. Whether it's a good friend, a loved one, or maybe even a total stranger that may be in despair. And you can really help somebody, you know, change the course of the next moments or hours in their life that may have a tremendous effect. But as Dr. Brombitt, I'm sure, sees, you can have somebody really immersed in treatment and they may still take their life. And, you know, you think everything is going well. So it is hard to predict. It's hard to understand. It's a great unknown. And everyone's working to try to get a person to deal with the underlying issues that cause them perhaps to self-medicate and have the feelings they have about themselves and get over that so they can start to feel good about themselves. And then they can start to feel good about those they interact with, and they can get their life on a better path.
Aaron, I thought of you when I wrote this question down. I'd certainly be eager for any of the three of you to jump in on this question. But is there are there things that well-meaning people say that are just not helpful?
Oh, of course. They say things like it's time to move on, or if it wouldn't have been now, it would have happened some other time. A lot of things that people say that, but for me, I know that it's coming from love, and it's people who just don't know what to say. And it's things that they've always heard or thought, or, you know, people often say that it was selfish. And I don't see that at all. I don't feel like I've been put out one bit. It wasn't about me. It was about him. You know, it was his path. The selfish one is a really hard one to kind of combat. And I think that goes with stigma. When we talked about stigma and And it's just part of the mix, I guess. You know, and the time to move on thing, you know, you just don't move on. So it's really not an option. It's a beautiful thought, but not realistic.
Yeah.
Aaron, I can piggyback on that thought that you had there, Ezra, if I may.
Sure.
I think that, you know, what I've noticed and what I've heard from individuals, you know, coming in for treatment or either having attempted suicide or contemplating it, is that at times you'll hear close ones not take it seriously or maybe shame them, whether indirectly or directly, like, get over it, it's in your head. I think, yeah, it is a product of your brain, and yes, it's part of your mind, but, you know, it's an illness, and it's something that, you know, we can deal with in a treatment setting, and that there are biological underpinnings to that as well. And I think that's important to, again, identify the reaching out for help or someone's willingness to share their struggle with another being a strength, and really harnessing that strength and using that to thread the needle of hope.
When we're talking about this notion that Aaron brought up of, we hear it so often. People say it like they know what they're talking about, that suicide is just a selfish option. If you do that, you're just creating trouble down the road for somebody else. I mean, where does that idea even come from? It seems like such an unsupportive idea. Like the idea that I would talk to somebody who has suicidal ideations and try to convince them that they're being selfish by doing that seems in itself like self-centered of me to make the problem about me.
Yeah. Can I just say one thing about that is,
yeah,
I could almost flip it around to the way that I've been able to create a story now is that it was very selfless. I think Christopher struggled so hard for so long, and then we have a daughter who's almost three now. And I personally believe that he was afraid of what he was going to maybe inflict on her as far as trauma, pain, with his addiction, his mental health, his coupled with rage and his cycle, that I just believe he knew all too well. So in my heart, I believe that it was selfless.
Dr. Brambett, what's your reaction?
Yeah, Aaron, thank you for sharing that. And I think that, that I have heard where folks at times are at the moment thinking that this might be a better option even for their family because of the pathological thinking that takes over. You know, we have our, you know, emotional, our limbic brain, fight or flight response, and then you have your, you know, prefrontal cortex, your executive functioning, your rational thinking, which at the time may not be actually functioning optimally. So in the throes of a depression, and maybe there may be some secondary benefit if there is a, you know, life insurance policy or some type of inheritance that may come to fruition for the family. So there could be a thought process of selflessness in it. But I know that's a difficult one to grapple because the large unknown is that person is no longer with us to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Mm. It's an interesting thought process, and of course, thank you, Aaron, for sharing. Our conversation is going to continue. It's really hard even to know how to just pitch to a station break here. Such an important conversation we're in the middle of. But of course, you're listening to Newsmakers, and our show will continue in just a moment. If you'd like to hear part of this conversation that you might have missed, you can find it on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. We'll be back in just a minute. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us today. We have three guests talking with us about suicide awareness and prevention. Dr. Neil Brombat is a psychiatry and behavioral health provider at Gunderson Health System. Judge Todd Bierke is with the National Alliance on Mental Illness in La Crosse and Vernon County. And Erin Swigum is a family nurse practitioner at Vernon Memorial, and she's also been sharing her personal connection to the issue of suicide and the death of her husband, Christopher. And I'm appreciative of all three of our guests talking with us today. The big thing that everybody has been going through this year has been COVID-19, many people experiencing major life upsets due to the pandemic. I'm curious, Dr. Brombat, maybe we'll start with you on this one, talking about the effect of something like this pandemic experience that we've been through on people's mental state of mind, especially those who might be at risk for suicide. How has it all affected suicide in our area or even nationwide?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Ezra. And I do believe that what I've seen in my experience in the hospital during the pandemic is an increase in the number of acute crises or hospitalization of folks who otherwise we may not have seen coming in a crisis state. And I do think that the pandemic leading to increased isolation and, you know, reduced access to resources, at least during that, you know, really acute time, or a fear to maybe even access those resources, coupled with that loneliness, increase in alcohol consumption and drug use as well. I think all those factors have increased mental health crises and suicide risk and attempts. And
Judge Bierke, what about your experience in the courts? Have you seen a heightened level of people with these traumatic experiences landing them in the legal system due to COVID, or is that a difficult thing to quantify?
Well, I think it's somewhat difficult. Most of the people I see are people that can't deal with stress in general, and may self-medicate to alleviate their inability to deal with the stress, and then they get in trouble because of that. So obviously the pandemic was a very stressful situation. They're out of work, that's stressful. They're looking at evictions, that's stressful. You add all those things up to the fact that they probably grew up in a household where they've had adverse child experiences, which affects their mental health. Perhaps bullying in school, all these things. I mean, it's just such a quagmire to try to sift through and find out what you really need to work on when you're trying to deal with somebody that is suffering. When did that truly come on? But a lot of the people have this lifelong experience that they just have not really been able to get a good handle on. PTSD generally is something that maybe is a more sudden onset, but it can be something that's prolonged, but it can come just about any time in your life. So it doesn't have to have that historical connection to it. But you know, every time someone comes into my courtroom, no matter how they act with me, I assume they have a story that they may want to share, they may not want to share. But I always try to pry into it just a little bit to make sure that they are addressing any needs that they may have at the end of their case to know if they're hopefully going to deal with the stresses of life. But I agree, the pandemic was stressful. For 15 months, I did all my hearings by Zoom, and I'm still continuing to do hearings by Zoom in La Crosse County. That's our default way of handling court. And, you know, people sometimes don't have the means to get on properly, or they're struggling even to get on with that. We're taking that into account as well to try to be more patient with people and not increase their stress, hopefully decrease it as much as possible. But in my profession, just about everybody is dealing with stress at a high level.
Indeed. So, Dr. Brombat, what about we see obviously certain conditions passed down from one generation or another, more prevalent in one family or another. What about these underlying issues that may lead to suicide? Do you see these things become generational, or is this just on a case-by-case individual basis? Some people might be prone to it, some people might not.
Yes, there is a some genetic link, and we'll see that with illnesses such as bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, and even addictions. But I am a firm believer that any individual, if they seek help and they seek help early, and surround themselves with treatment, and if they have a support group and a support system, that they have a really good chance at doing well, and so that there is hope, that it's not a blueprint for a disaster necessarily. Sometimes those genes don't even manifest if you don't have the right environmental stressors. So there is a correlation between very frequent and heavy marijuana use and having a genetic predisposition to, a psychotic illness like schizophrenia, seeing that precipitate earlier.
Aaron, when we were talking about your experience, you talked about some of the resources that you've used after your husband's death, grief resources, that sort of thing. You also talked about the importance of finding purpose as even including it among the stages of grief. I'm interested to hear more about that and what, how that worked for you and what that's resulting in.
Well, to start with, I took 2 months off of work after his death, and I ended it in my last week off of listening to Desmond Tutu and the Dalai Lama's Book of Joy. And that really helped me to kind of switch my perspective to seeing joy. And then with that, I was able to start thinking about purpose and what, how I could take this story and make it part of my life and part of the work that I'm here to do. And for me, it was connecting to God. It brought me closer to faith, and so personally finding purpose, what I'm currently doing is I left my clinic practice and went to the emergency department, because for whatever reason, the clinic practice just didn't feel the same. It didn't feel as meaningful to me. So I've just been kind of sitting and waiting, and a group of local people sought me out 3-4 months ago, and I've been working with them in discussions of starting a federally qualified health center in Crawford County, which is where I was raised, was in Crawford County. And it's very much a healthcare desert. There's a lot of meth addiction there. I see that as kind of my focus group, where in a federally qualified health center provides access to dental, behavioral health, and medical. So I'm working closely with a group on that and seeing that good will happen, even if it's only conversations, which I'm hopeful that it will be more, but just opening up the conversations to helping those who have less. And so that's one thing. The other thing I'm working on is I started to realize that when I see trauma now, even in the emergency department, I struggle to see medicine, and I see more that this is the worst day of these people's life and what's going to happen to them tomorrow and the next day. So I have an interview coming up with Gunderson for the chaplain program. So I'm excited about that. I can see myself fitting in that role, or even just finding more purpose for my own self and my own path through that role.
It's interesting to hear how you've taken that horrible experience that you've been through, and not that not in sort of gratefulness for the experience itself, but using that to the reality that it exists, and turning it into something positive is I think really inspirational for me anyway to hear. Thank you for sharing about that.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Brombat, I want to give everybody an opportunity to reiterate ways that they can be in touch with your various organizations if they feel as though this is a conversation that they need to continue in terms of their own mental health or in terms of something that they learned on this program that might be valuable. What's the best advice if somebody feels like they might need help from a provider like you at someplace like Gunderson?
One of the important messages is that, you know, again, it's a strength to reach out for help and that you are not alone. You know, we are here to help you. And whether it's connecting with a family or a friend or a colleague, loved one, you know, take that first step, reach out and ask for some help. In terms of our resources at Gunderson, you know, if you're connected to our system, you have a primary care doctor here, you can talk to your primary care doctor. They can refer you to us in behavioral health. But, you know, I think the big takeaway is just taking that first step and reaching out for some help and knowing that's a strength within each individual to do so. And that hopelessness is transient despite the severity that you may be feeling of that hopelessness at the time.
Judge Bierke, what about the National Alliance on Mental Illness, the La Crosse-Vernon County's chapter? How can people find information about that and reach out if those resources might be helpful?
I'm glad you asked about that, Ezra. NAMI La Crosse is our local chapter. We cover La Crosse and Vernon County. Just go to the website and search NAMI La Crosse, and they'll bring up our site. People can also go to NAMI Wisconsin and find resources throughout the state. A lot of things have been done, you know, online or through Zoom over the last year. And, you know, someone in La Crosse could actually access a group over in Green Bay, for instance, or somewhere else in the state. So they can connect people. Some of the main signature programs that NAMI gives is family to family, where they can get families to work through issues with mental health. The peer support group, where a person themselves suffering or actually has someone in their family suffering can work with another peer. And the family support group as well. And, you know, it's not just for the person that is actually suffering from the mental issues, but also for the family that needs to understand it better. So NAMI is a good resource to try to cover all those bases. And I suggest that people try to look at those sites and see what type of information they have and reach out if they're interested. Our local group has people like Dr. Brown, but educate the public on our monthly educational programs. You know, everyone's invited. We've been doing those by Zoom over the last year. Hopefully we can go back to in-person events sometime in the future. But NAMI is a very good source of information to help people learn and understand and hopefully deal with mental health issues.
Aaron Swigum is a nurse practitioner in urgent care at Vernon Memorial. Aaron, I don't know how many people would need to reach out to Vernon Memorial in the same way that they might reach out to NAMI. It's more of an acute thing in your department anyway, and for people who live in the area. But what resource might you like to point to in terms of where people should be going for a little more help if they need it?
You know, having an honest conversation with your loved ones is the first step, if that's possible. For me personally, I've tried on my Facebook page, I'm very transparent, and I've tried to reduce stigma, including my own story of healing and health, and then including Christopher's. So I think the more that we're transparent and honest with each other, the more people can be honest in reaching out for help. One thing I think that we don't think enough about is I think you can walk into any church and say, I need help. Priests are trained to help most often. So if that's ever an area where you're comfortable and you know that you have access, just walk in and say you need help. And then your family practice doctor, have an honest conversation with them about how you're doing. Call the clinic. Those, you know, some people are very connected to their family practice doctor and the nurse team and would be willing to have that conversation, especially with the nurse. I mean, nurses are trained also to be very empathetic and see you as a whole person, not just a disease.
That's Erin Swigum, who's been sharing her personal story with us today, in addition to her experiences there at Vernon Memorial. Erin, thank you very much for joining us today on Newsmakers.
Thank you, Ezra.
Judge Todd Bjerke is the board president for the National Alliance on Mental Illness in La Crosse that serves La Crosse County and Vernon County. Judge Bjerke, thank you very much for being on Newsmakers today.
Thank you for having me, Ezra.
Dr. Neil Brombett is a psychiatry and behavioral health provider at Gunderson Health System. Dr. Brombett, thank you very much for your expertise today.
Thank you for having me.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. There are a couple of opportunities to hear our program every week. On Friday mornings at 10, we're on Ideas 90.3. Friday evenings, 7 o'clock, it's NPR News and Music 88.9. And we're always online, of course, at WPR.org/newsmakers. And you can always reach out to us directly by sending an email to newsmakers@WPR.org. Thanks today to my producer, Dawn Jewell. This is Ezra Wall. Please join us again next week for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.